Well, welcome everyone. This is Scott Carley with the College of Exploration, and this is our the March 6, 2012 telecon for the Climate Literacy Network, and so welcome to everyone. So as many of you know, if you've seen the announcement that got you to this telecon, Tamara is busy with the NRC roundtable, so that's kind of a competing thing, which may actually mean that several people are actually involved in the roundtable rather than being on this call. So they'll be very interested in the recording. So as I said, welcome. And as we normally do, we start off with announcements. Are there any announcements that people would like to share?
I don't have an announcement, but I have a question. This is
Kirby. Sure, jump in, please.
Are there slides available for today's presentation? Because they weren't in tomorrow's email.
They are. They're on the webpage for the telecon schedule. So that URL, is, I remember, was actually in the announcement.
I'll try to figure it out.
I'm just checking here. Do you know, it actually isn't. Tamara normally puts it in there. So if folks do not have the slides yet, they are under cleannet.org/CLN. And then you'll see on the left-hand side, I think it says CLN Telecon. And it should be, it'll be the entry under Jessica's name. Yeah, I see that Tamara just put the URL for the NRC roundtable. So any other questions? We're just kind of a few moments just to let people download. They haven't had a chance to do that because it's kind of important. To be able to follow along. Any other questions, comments? There's lots going on in climate change education these days. I'll take that. I have no other announcement. So, if there aren't any announcements, I'm going to just introduce Jessica Thompson. She's a assistant professor in a very interesting department called Human Dimensions of Natural Resources Department at Colorado State. And Jessica, the bio is there on the webpage, and she's going to talk about Changing the Conversation, a Place-Based Approach to Climate Change Education and Engagement on America's Public Lands. So take it away, Jess.
All right. Thank you. Good morning, afternoon. And, I'll just start with this is one of the funded climate change in, education partnerships, a phase one effort. And our core team included CSU and the National Park Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Parks Conservation Association. And so what I want to do in the next, hopefully, 45, 50 minutes, I'll try to go quickly so we have lots of time for questions, but if at any point you want to interrupt and ask, please feel free to do so, is I want to back up and give you a glimpse of our theoretical framework, like how we got inspired to move in this direction, and then summarize some of the audience research that we've done over the past 16 months, and then give you a preview of what we're hoping to put together in our phase two proposal and submit next. I have to have it to my sponsored research office next week. So it's getting very close, but it's very exciting, and it's been such a wonderful project to work with the National Parks and the Fish and Wildlife Service. So what is place-based engagement? Now I'm on slide 3. And it's about two-way communication that is situated in a unique context, in a place that is meaningful for people, where audiences interact and communicate with the landscape as well as each other. And what we found is when people visit a national park or a national wildlife refuge, they typically don't go alone, that it's part of a social outing. And so that is a powerful opportunity to link both the social and the ecological understanding of human impacts on the environment. And so that's where, you know, that's sort of our two lines on what is place-based climate change engagement. But it goes back to the summer of 2009 when Senator McCain and Senator Udall came to visit Rocky Mountain National Park. And you can see these photos of McCain and Udall, and they're talking with Ben Babowski, the chief of natural resources at the park. And the headline to the Denver Post the next morning was, "Every citizen in America should see what's happening here." And that was McCain. And the chief had given them this fabulous tour looking at bark beetle infestation in the pine forest, invasive cheatgrass, rock glacier ice is melting up there, pikas are disappearing, and large mountain ecosystems are essentially being fragmented. So there were all of these changes, and McCain and Udall could see them, and that was really powerful for them, and that got me thinking, this is interesting. And I do some work with the Association for Conflict Resolution. They have an environmental conflict group, and they were having their national or their annual meeting in Denver. And one of the conference organizers said, "Hey, Jess, you work with the park. Can you hook us up on a field trip? You know, do whatever you want. Make it a climate change thing. Don't you work on that?" And I was like, "Yeah, I have this great idea." So I called the chief of research up at the park and said, "Could I bring a group of people who are in town in Denver for a few days, and let's go around and do this same sort of climate change tour that you did with McCain and Udall?" And it was great. We headed up there, went on hikes, went around Sprague Lake. We looked at this is, I think I'm on slide 6 now, the pine tree. You can see that those yellow pussy blobs are pitch tubes, which are essentially created when pine beetles bore into a tree and then push the sap and wood dust out. And then you can see over the landscape, those redder, those almost burgundy colored trees are all ones that have died from pine beetle, because without a nice cold winter, which kills pine beetle eggs, the larvae continue, they're increasing their reproductive cycle. So this was pretty interesting, and it's led to lots of decisions that had to be made about natural resources. So we go to Glacier Basin Campground, and we're walking around. And this is, you can see in the little picture up on the left, it used to be a very forested campground. I don't know if you can see, but back in the main picture, there's a pile of this bluish wood, which is pine beetle kill. And they've built this great amphitheater at the park, at the campground site, for talking about pine beetle kill. And we're just kind of going through the motions, and they're telling us the impacts and how it influences decision making when it comes to natural resource management. And I feel this hand on my shoulder, and I turn, and it's one of the participants. She's a professor, conflict in Florida, actually, and she looks bright red and almost like she's having an allergic reaction. I'm like, "Oh geez, let's sit down. Are you okay? We're at like 9,000 feet. Surely this is altitude sickness." I'm, you know, digging in my pack trying to find a Benadryl, and she's a woman in probably late 40s, maybe early 50s, and says, I wish I brought my parents." And I'm like, "This is weird. You wish you brought..." I'm like, maybe she's getting delusional. She needs water. And she's sort of, her voice gets crackly, and she says they don't believe in climate change. And I was like, oh, where is this going? And I listen, and she tells me how as a child, every other summer they came. She was originally from South Dakota, I believe, and she had cousins in Longmont, which is a town, almost one of the gateway communities for Rocky Mountain National Park. And they would camp here every other summer, and she could tell me about making sandwiches and packing her bag to go on a hike and riding her bike through the... I mean, she just had this exquisite detail of her experience at this place. And she was very emotional. You know, by now she's crying. I'm nearly crying, just like realizing how powerful this random campground is to her psychological well-being. And in my head, I'm thinking, oh man, the Park Service doesn't need to worry about climate change. They need to start hiring grief counselors, because there's going to be a whole bunch of baby boomers coming back to these places, and they're different, and they're changing, and that's going to have impacts. And So I found that really powerful, and in the end it was really about climate change and how it's changed this place and how she thought if her parents saw it, they would believe it. And I thought I was on to something then, and I started going around giving talks in different places, getting invited here and there, and I was telling the story in Alaska, and I can't believe it. This gentleman came up afterwards, and he said, he works for the Park Service now, and he said, "I'm really mad at you." I'm like, "Oh, I'm sorry. Did I step on your toes?" I was, you know, talking about the Park Service and what they're doing or not doing, and and he said, "No, you ruined it for me. I have a picture in my head of what Glacier Basin looks like, and you ruined it." I am not kidding you. He had the exact same story that he had gone there. And so you can see in the next slide, he had finished digitizing some of his father's old photos, and that's his sister and his mother. I think this was about 1959, and they had set up camp, and this was at Glacier Basin. And I'm like, wow, I can't believe this. So I'm giving this talk in Seattle in last October, and the same thing. A gentleman comes up, Adam Lorio, who's works on the Samish Indian Reservation, and he said, "Well, you can add Seattle to the list because that is a place that I used to camp." And I had no idea. I mean, I knew the campground was there. I'd never been there before, but again, tears welling in his eyes, he told me the story of how he camped there with his family and how he didn't even recognize the place when I pulled up the photo, that he just thought it was photoshopped. He didn't know where I was going with it. So places, powerful. And that really led us to pull together a theoretical framework. And this is just because my work is it's really at this intersection of natural resources, environmental education, and organizational communication. And taking what we know about place attachment theory, place-based learning, which is really, you know, environmental education, free choice learning, John Falk's work has been amazing, especially for places like parks and refuges, national forests, and then norm activation theory, and distilling that to the idea that we can engage people in a climate change conversation when it's situated in a place, it has a cultural context, and it empowers a specific action. So now I'm at slide 10, and these are really our theoretical underpinnings. Audiences are connected to place. They have these unique bonds. They value places in very emotional and powerful ways. And then they learn through hands-on activities, through doing something in that place. And then they remember, and they're more likely to adopt behaviors when they feel a sense of responsibility and they have knowledge of those consequences. So we've used that to frame our phase one proposal, which ultimately the question was on slide 11, how can we change the conversation about climate change through the lens of places we love? And so, like I said before, our partnership with National Parks Conservation Association, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the National Park Service, and we went to, those were all national level partners, and we went to them and said, where are the priority areas? Where do we need to pilot this work in phase one? And they immediately said, well, we're right here in northern Colorado. That's important. The Kenai Peninsula of Alaska is experiencing massive change. South Florida and the Keys, big changes. And then Puget Sound had been working on climate change for a long time, and the agency representatives felt like they really needed to rejuvenate the conversation on communicating about that science, at least among their natural resource managers. So that was a no-brainer. And then the D.C. area was, and the Park Service advocated for this real strongly. Like, we need to go to D.C. We need to make not only the project visible, but talk about urban climate change impacts and how they relate to natural resources. So those were our five pilot sites in phase one. Our specific objectives were to identify the issues and impacts that need to be communicated. Ultimately, what are the climate change effects, like the pine beetle kill we saw at Rocky Mountain National Park? And then find out what they're currently doing to communicate about climate change. Identify specific barriers and opportunities for ramping up that engagement. And then integrate all of that in a place-based education strategy. No problem. Totally doable in 15 months. It's been so awesome. We've gone to so many places and have met incredible incredible people, passionate frontline interpreters who know their resources and their visitors exquisitely. So to gather the information we needed, our external consultant did a survey of agency staff and partners, and then we did exactly 16 site visits and hosted 16 focus groups with our partners. We hosted 5 different World Cafe workshops in each of those regions, and then we had a 6th strategic planning workshop. We also collected visitor, or what I call external audience data, with a survey and interviews. I'm sort of one of these people that likes to blend the qualitative with the quantitative, and I think that's given us a really rich perspective on what audiences know and understand about climate change. So those were the specific activities we've done since last September, and now I just want to share our results. So as far as issues and impacts, we specifically met with natural resource managers and scientists who work at the parks and refuges. And overwhelmingly, everywhere we went, as you can see in the northern Colorado slide, over 80% said we can see several impacts of climate change right now, today. The Colorado has seen significant warming, increasing extreme weather events, all within the latter half of the 20th century. And alongside the warming, the mountainous West has seen much earlier snow melt, decreasing snowpack, and rapid melting of glaciers. We're also seeing loss of species synchronization, and that's causing some species shift, namely the pika, that adorable little guy in the far corner there, and the ptarmigan. And it's not just fauna, it's lots of flora as well. Forest dieback due to increased forest pets, and then these stressors are likely interacting to compound, issues that facilitate more wildland fires. So that was our Northern Colorado. So we get this information primarily from the resource managers, but we also had engaged climate scientists in each region to verify the impacts. In South Florida, across the board, nearly every resource manager said that coral beet leaching is an issue. A little different than Colorado, 68% of managers said, yes, we can see several effects now. And 23rd said maybe only 1 to 2, but coral bleaching was in the top category, as well as ocean acidification, which is just, the evil twin to climate change. So sea level rise, abnormal weather pattern and storm, and, of course, areas in South Florida have experienced up to a 2.5 degrees Fahrenheit increase in temperature during the latter part of the 20th century. And they're estimating that 4.5 degrees by the end of the 21st century. So pretty powerful statistics on the changes at that landscape. In the Puget Sound, in Washington, D.C., this was really interesting because we were thinking, oh, here's a place that maybe we haven't seen the changes as rapidly, but there are definitely parts of the Anacostia River that are increasing in sea level, and they're projecting future increases. In fact, the managers of National Capital Parks East, which actually manages about 12 different sites in the National Capital Region, they have strategic plans about moving sidewalks and benches because of increased water levels. They've also had an increase in 0.8 degrees Celsius during the 20th century and a projected increase of 3.5 degrees during the 21st century. Like I said, sea level has risen about 36 centimeters. Again, during the 21st century. So they have all of these observations and changing vegetation patterns. Those of you who are in D.C., maybe the cherry blossoms, God, I hope they're not blooming now. I hope they're not. But that was a big cultural as well as ecological impact for a lot of the folks when we were there. They were saying, you know, this is a big part of this town. We have this cherry blossom festival, and now by the time the festival comes along, the blossoms are gone. And I'll keep trying to move quickly through some of these. At the Kenai Peninsula of Alaska, really interesting story here that for centuries, essentially, since they had been monitoring, they hadn't seen lightning. Sorry, I'm getting a little feedback. Hopefully that's not bothering anyone else. And now they have instances of lightning more frequent in the interior of Alaska, but they're starting to see it on the Kenai, which is something that, can you imagine? They just never had lightning instances. It's just not part of their weather pattern. And much more intense storms, and obviously glacial retreat is a very visible change. And typically in the winters, the glaciers grow, they replenish, but that isn't happening. And so without that winter recharge, they retreat even more rapidly in the summer. And then finally, the Puget Sound has the same sort of glacier melting and recession in their national parks. They are also recognizing changes in precipitation, and it's altering patterns of runoff and their freshwater flow. Also, an increase in algae blooms in the Puget Sound itself, which is creating ultimately dead zones. And they have a lot of the same pine beetle or forest fires and forest pest increases. In fact, one of the refuge managers said that, yeah, we're really worried about the pine beetle, but right behind the pine beetle are another 27 species of beetle that we have to prepare for and how they might infest the forest in the Pacific Northwest. So moving from the impacts and issues, I'm going to transition to the current activities. And again, this is across the board of the nearly 372 partners. And I mean partners, again, these are the managers and now more of the interpreters who work at the different parks and refuges in those five areas. And they said, we're doing programs with schools. We get elementary school kids to our sites. We don't necessarily talk about climate change, but we're doing that. We have more workshops and meetings on climate change, and in a few places they were creating, you know, park brochures that talked about climate impacts. A lot of one-way stuff. A few places had experimented with interpretive programming, but found that when they labeled it the climate change campfire talk, that no one came. But when they called it this was up at Rocky. They called it Changes in Wildflowers. Or they turned it into a wildflower walk, and they talked about the different blooming and the vegetation shifts. They had a lot more people, so that was just in the framing of it. So we've learned neat things about some of the current activities that they're doing and what's working and what's not working. We asked them what they saw as the barrier and the opportunity, and this probably resonates with a lot of your work, but they didn't see a connection to people's everyday. They really believe that their audience is not interested, that they're apathetic. One interpreter told me, he said, Jess, you know, talking about climate change for me is like interpreting Civil War sites. I'm worried that there's a neo-Confederate in the audience and they're going to take me to the cleaners in a discussion in front of a lot of other people. And I don't want to open that up and let a climate, as Ed Maybach called it last week, one of the unconvinced take over the conversation. And so they're really hesitant to bring it up. They feel it's really politicized. They feel that people are scientifically illiterate for the most part. So those were their barriers. But overwhelmingly, we were really aligned on some of the opportunities they see. Bringing youth in, getting them connected to the places is going to be really important because once they know the place, they can protect the place and they can care about changes and impacts. Focusing on those local and visible changes, they see that even as small ones, those are opportunities to bring up the dynamic and the complexity of climate change. And also, collaboration. In fact, for these agencies, I keep saying, okay, guys, we've got to do something transformative. They're like, we're talking to each other. That is crazy. That the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Park Service rarely network across their boundaries. And here in all five of those regions, there were sites that were coupled, that there was a refuge that, you know, would border a national park. And I had the ambition that would have brought Forest Service into the mix too, because they have just as much property that is near, if not adjacent to, parks and refuges as well. So we saw those as the opportunities. And then if we go back to what we needed to do, okay, we've got the current activities, we've got the issues and impacts, we've got the barriers, we're set. Now we need to pull it together.
Do you want to pause between the games and have a little breakfast? It's fun, isn't it?
I'm kind of hungry too, but anyhow, we needed for this last piece, integrating ideas for that place-based strategy, the number one thing is we need to know our audience. And so that's when we really hit the internal and external audience. The internal audience we're categorizing as those agency staff, the external, the visitors, the people who are already at the parks and refuges. Now, the parks and refuge visitors are, they're older, average age 54. They are highly educated and really white. And this, it shouldn't be a surprise for the National Park Service. If you could look at visitor data for the past 40 years, and this is the demographic who have the resources and the time to visit national parks. So that was the audience, at least, we were dealing with. And we thought, okay, what else do we know about audiences? And we immediately turned to Six Americas, who does this fabulous audience segmentation study. Everybody knows about this. And I love that the Kleisen, the study on the zoo and aquarium visitors, found, and their results are even better, but we're different. The people who visit parks and refuges are different. And one of my graduate students did this cluster analysis trying to replicate Ed Maybach and Tony Lazorowicz's work, and found that we've got a bigger chunk of people in that end of the spectrum, that alarmed category. Just like the Kleisen study, I think they had 24% in the alarmed category. So we've got people at this end of the continuum who are really concerned. They want to know more about climate change, and so we asked them. So here are the results of our primary research. We asked the staff, are the effects of climate change visible? We asked the visitors, and you can see 71% of staff said, yes, we can see these. We can see changes right now. And 24% of visitors said, yes, definitely. And another 46% said, yeah, probably. I mean, more than a majority thinks that these changes are happening and they're visible. We asked the staff, are your visitors concerned about climate change? And they said, well, maybe, somewhat. They're in the middle of the hump here. And this is always fun. I mean, you guys have my slides, so you can scoop me here. But look, there's just 1% extremely concerned. Look at this next slide. We asked the visitors, are you concerned about climate change? 22% extremely concerned. Is this, for me, emphasize the fact that the parks and refuge, that the staff didn't know their audience that well, and they didn't realize how concerned they are. And so for several folks that I've talked to since we've done this research, they've said, that helps me so much. That gives me so much more confidence going out and working on special climate change projects just within our park or refuge unit. And then we said, should they be communicating about climate change? I mean, really? And the staff said, yes. And the visitors, over 67%, yes, definitely. So this is where things get a little more interesting. We said, are you willing to change your behavior during your visit to help reduce the impacts of climate change? Really getting at what sort of mitigation activities could we, and would people want to? I mean, here they are on vacation with their family. We've heard people say, oh, climate change is a big, dreary issue. I don't want to get bummed out. But if they could do something, they would be ecstatic. Look at that, 29% extremely willing to do something. Another 38% very willing. I mean, we've got an audience that is primed. They're concerned. They want to do something. They're knowledgeable. And so we ask them, how do you want to learn about climate change? And, I typically reveal these in a little, like, David Letterman top 10 list style. If you want to see them, just delete those boxes. I'm on slide 31 now. Roadside exhibits, guided walks and talks, really popular. Nearly a third of people wanted to see more movies, videos, as well as the traditional printed material. Indoor exhibits, surprisingly, and a lot of this was Alaska, Puget Sound, places where the elements get a little more fierce. They wanted to have, you know, a window where they could look out and have an idea of where they should be looking. Trailside exhibits, really popular, and this blew our mind. They want to learn it from the website. And we probed that with our interviews, and we found that people, they want to be able to call up the information on their own. They want to be, you know, they want a QR code that they can scan and get more. And while they're right, standing right there, like, they might have questions, but a very small fraction of the people who visit parks, and definitely refuges, this is certainly the case, actually go on interpretive walks. In fact, most refuges don't even have interpretive staff to facilitate that. And then the people who visit parks, you know, there might be one or two walks offered in a day, but people tend to wander around on their own, and they want to be able to have questions answered about changes that they're seeing in the landscape, and they want to be able to do it on mobile devices. They also want to know this information when they plan their visit. So a lot of people who go to a national park or a refuge go to the plan your visit site. I mean, it's a whole section. Here's different hikes, things to do for a one-day visit, things to do for a two-day visit. And they thought, you know, a visitor that we interviewed said, it would be great if I knew what things are changing and what I should go see. And one person even said, that's why I took my family to Glacier National Park, because I wanted them to see the glaciers before it's the park formerly known as Glacier National Park. So that sort of element that there's a scarcity and here's an opportunity to see impacts firsthand, and being able to incorporate that in their visit planning was pretty important for folks. So then we go back to our partners, and we had, like I said, these five World Cafe-style conversations. These were one-day workshops, and we asked, who's your target audience? What actions do you want to promote? Essentially, what do you want the audience to do, and how do you want to engage them in doing that? So, again, across all five sites, children and youth were the number one pick. Several sites, the staff was a close second, if not tied for first. In fact, in Alaska, Puget Sound, and D.C., the staff was tied for first. We need to focus on the youth, and we need to focus on our own people. And then the web audience, and a lot of that came out of our visitor research. Well, they're like, well, people on the web want to know about these changes. People want websites, so let's focus on our web audience. When we said, what do you want them to do? They want people to know, and again, this is coming from the partners, from those refuge managers, those park superintendents, the frontline interpreters, the resource managers, as well as the park and refuge scientists. They want people to know that they want them to feel empowered. They want them to understand these local examples. And real important to that is they want them to have a connection to place. They want them to value this place. They want to appreciate that they don't need to know everything about climate change. And they especially wanted that for their staff, that staff often seem like, oh, man, I'm going to have to read up. I'm going to have to know everything about atmospheric chemistry to even be able to start talking about the impact of the carbon site. And it's not that way. And they also want people to feel empowered to take responsibility from everything, from understanding the science to making lifestyle choices. And how do they want to do that? They want to do it through telling these very personal stories about changing landscapes. Now, if you have ever been to a campfire talk or interpretive walk, some of these interpreters are master storytellers. They're incredible. And the power of their stories is really, it's, it's emotional, it's magic, it pulls you in, you feel connected to them, you feel connected to the place. It's all part of the experience. And so they want to continue to build on that strength. That's something they do well, and it's very personal. And if they can figure out other mechanisms for that, you know, to create some web storytelling by using new technology and social media. They're also really interested in citizen science programs and linking that to youth programs, as well as making connections about climate change to other issues that are more readily and more meaningfully available to audiences, like families. One person said, you know, this isn't a science issue. It's not a political issue. This is a generational issue. This has everything to do with what my children and their children and their children have to deal with. That is about patriotism. National security depends on us protecting our landscape. And then just finding other ways to make it personally irrelevant. And then to make it hopeful that the problem with climate change is that it's been such a downer, and that there's got to be a way to reframe it so that it feels empowering, so it feels like we can do something. So then we go back to our theoretical framework after all this research, and we did this ridiculous literature review on climate change communication, trying to synthesize, you know, over 260 articles in the past 4 years. I mean, you guys know this literature is just exponentially growing. It's exploding. And we said what we need in each of these areas are regional climate change communities of practice, communities where you've got a refuge manager, a park manager, and some NGOs, maybe local school teacher, coming together to say, let's get synchronized. Let's talk about these impacts that we're seeing in a landscape scale. Or we keep using the word ecotone, like this 100-mile radius. And when we presented this idea, they said, yeah, that's fabulous. That's exactly what we need. We need more collaboration across our jurisdictions. But we don't have people to do that. We don't have money, and we don't have any more time with the people who are doing it. So I said, hey, that's something that phase two could do. Phase two could put a regional coordinator in each place to facilitate that conversation and keep it going. They got real excited about that. And then we ultimately wanted to turn this into a climate education experiment, because there were everywhere we went, they want to do lots, right? You say, what do you guys want to do? And we want to do camps and signs and, oh, and we need to use mobile technology and we got to do more training. So everyone wants to do something. So, well, why don't each region take the lead on one thing? You develop it in the first year or two, evaluate it, tweak it, and then you create a training and a template for other areas to adopt it as appropriately as possible for your audiences. And the thing that surprised me, and I didn't think that climate camps were going to be the answer, but some folks in the North Cascades National Park, who have partnered with the North Cascades Institute, did a Cascades Climate Challenge, did this camp in 2009, and they did it again in 2010. And in 2011, they did it in combination with another camp that they run through the Institute just because of budget and funding. And I've got a link to a video. Go check it out. But we had some of those kids come to our workshop. I shouldn't say kids. These young adults are brilliant. They're really inspiring. They came and they talked about the camp and that experience and that connection to place and the power of that 2 weeks in the wilderness and talking with scientists and seeing changes firsthand. But the other piece of it, and I think this is the beauty in it, is they have to go out and do, after the camp, there's a service component, and they're charged with educating 30 people about climate change. And they can do this through school programming. They can do it through, I mean, they can pick however they want to do it. And they were just telling me about amazing things that they were doing in their community, just becoming youth ambassadors for climate change. And sometimes it was in the context of formal education, but a lot of times it was outside of the classroom. It was, you know, from going to Kiwanis meetings and giving a presentation to working at a community or developing and creating a plan for a community garden with a local preschool. I mean, it was really cool, the things they were starting to do. So that was exciting, and Colorado said, ooh, we could do that, but we don't want to do the two-week version. We'll do a one-week day camp for urban youth where we move from the Rocky Mountain Arsenal National Wildlife Refuge up to Rocky Mountain National Park, and we'll call it From Plains to Peaks. And over the course of 5 days, we'll see these different ecosystems and how they're changing. And so we're developing these different modules that could be adapted for some of the urban parks who don't have the infrastructure to host a two-week camp. So that's one tool that we're going to include in our phase two. The next is regional trail signs. So this is Southern Florida is taking the lead on this, and there's four different counties, but over seven sites. And what they want is essentially to have a trail which would have 21 different interpretive signs from Miami all the way out to Key West. And Dry Tortugas is this incredible island about 65 miles west of Key West. And then back up to 10,000 Islands National Wildlife Refuge, where they're talking about different impacts, but it's all linked. There's a consistent voice across these different jurisdictions. So real powerful for creating some community capacity, I should say regional capacity, and collaboration on that. And here's just page 38. It's just a couple of pictures of existing interpretive signs that they're going to figure out how to work within the current infrastructure to incorporate climate change where they can and where they want to build new. Washington, D.C. is going to take the lead on mobile apps. They actually already created one for just visiting the National Mall, but that region is going to develop some really cool technology that people could download and have that is really focused on climate. This is a staff training. Technically, it's our team visiting the Nisqually National Wildlife Refuge in Western Washington. And what they want to do is create field trips for staff within those communities, those regional communities of practice, to go see the other sites. I mean, it's really interesting. We travel with people and they're like, oh, I've never been to this national park site, or I've never been to this refuge site. And just creating an opportunity for folks to see the other landscapes right there and then turn it into a wider staff training event. We're also going to partner with Climate Interpreter and just create Scott McKenzie is going to help us create a platform for sharing all of the resources and tools. Again, the build it, test it, share it model is our philosophy for the first couple of years, and then having other places within the partnership and hopefully beyond adopt that template and the training to meet their needs, test it, and vet it and share it again. So I just want to conclude with, you know, our perspective on this is that there's no template. I mean, this really needs to be an experiment where we test multiple different strategies. That when it comes to climate change, we haven't really found the silver bullet for changing the conversation. But every step forward reveals, you know, more challenges as much as it reveals new insights and opportunities. And if we can link this understanding of ecological impacts and changes with our understanding of audiences, I think we can develop some really powerful powerful opportunities, windows to engage people in something meaningful. So I guess I'll just conclude right there. There's some of our undergraduate research team interns that spent their summer traveling the country. Man, we lucked out on this one. It was awesome. So I'd be really happy to spend the last 15 minutes or so answering any questions, or if you have any ideas, feedback, I'd love to hear it.
Well, thank you, Jessica. That was great. Just really, really interesting. So are there questions from folks on the phone?
Hi, this is Kristen Poppleton.
Yeah.
And this is really fun to listen to, Jessica. Actually, I think we met a long time back.
Yeah.
I was working with the National Parks Foundation. I know it's a competitor with the on the Parks Climate Challenge piece. And it's really, your work just sounds really exciting. We in Minnesota, we've been actually kind of more with less funding, obviously, you know, working on connecting, using this place idea. And so I'm really interested in, A, if you could send, if you had a bibliography or list of references for that look at this place-based piece. Coming from environmental ed, I know there's a lot of stuff in the past, but if there's some that's bringing in climate change or if you guys are publishing anything, I'd love to have that to sort of stand on.
Yeah.
Because your comment about there not really being a template, I think that's true, but I also think you kind of lined out the template that we've been working on, too, just that the starting point being what defines your place and how do you connect to it, and then how is your place changing after you've made that connection, you know, and what can we do about it sort of piece. And so we're working on that, and, you know, through our – we have a Minnesota's Changing Climate project and curriculum too. So it's really cool to hear about how it's working in different parks as well, from more the informal ed. Ours is more focused, you know, in the formal ed sphere. So,
Minnesota, Apostle Islands, is that far or?
We're working the part, well, so we do work, we also have our subgroup with through the Parks Climate Challenge, and we're working on actually getting funding again next year with them. So we've been working with a real small group focused more on professional development. It's really interesting to see those. Are you, I mean, it's out in the public sphere, your presentation now. Are you okay with me sharing some of those results?
Yes.
Oh, great. We're working with the Mississippi National River and Recreation Area, which is our urban park, which runs right through the Twin Cities and represents the Mississippi as a whole, but also the urban corridor. So having kids learn about the impacts of climate change on Minnesota, but specifically the Mississippi watershed, and thinking about projects that they can do to work on that. And next year, we're moving towards actually those projects being more phenology monitoring stuff. So really getting into the place, getting to know your place piece.
That's awesome.
And they're a great group just because they have a pretty focused education program. Apostle Islands doesn't do as much with education.
No.
And then we also have Voyageurs National Park way up north, but that also is not as focused. They don't have as much of an education piece. So.
Right. Yeah. Cool. And the watershed. So that's how we've organized the camps. Like for the North Cascades especially, that they're looking at the Nisqually watershed that essentially goes from the Sound to Mount Rainier and then on the Olympic Peninsula watershed. And so it's just really, I think that framing it that way and moving across parks and refuges and like through, like you said, the river corridor, which also has all these urban elements. You can talk about so many things, from human impact on the environment to, you know, changes in water quality and cycle, and just getting youth. And again, we're focusing like on 15 to 18 year olds. We're almost at adults, but they. I just think it's a really powerful opportunity. And probably when I talked to you, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago with the National Parks Foundation, I was like, camps, really, guys? Oh, that, you know, but now I've seen the results. So I feel like I'm someone who is like,
They've moved more circle. Towards professional development.
Yeah.
With funding just teachers and then the teachers bringing the students out. So
yeah.
North Cascades is actually one of the partners on that.
Cool.
The institute, the working with the teachers as well. So, and I believe Olympic might be in on it as well next year. So that would be interesting to look at how the parks, the teacher piece may be working in. You know, it's all going to be connected if there's overlap with some of the parks that are doing the professional development with teachers, but then also working with your project as well.
Yeah, well, kind of it would only make things stronger, right?
Right, exactly. Right.
Cool. Very cool.
Okay, this is Carol Mandrick. I wanted to say something and ask a question.
Yeah.
The first thing is, at the risk of making anybody else feel bad, I think this is one of the most thorough, informative presentations that's been in these Tuesdays. It was excellent.
Oh, thank you.
How you presented it, but I'm really impressed with what you've already accomplished.
Oh.
And, you know, you really have kind of laid out what the template should be, and there's a really clear vision. And I'm just thinking, okay, there's a limited number of phase twos. You guys should be a shoe-in for a phase two. I'm really excited listening to you talk about it. The question that I have is, you mentioned, you know, the huge amount of climate change communication literature, and suddenly it hit me that we all have that problem. And I wonder if this is something that has been talked about between the different CCEPs or something that could be talked about at the tri-agency meeting to, like, maybe share your sympathies or collaborate or something. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Yeah. I mean, I think you are right on. And I think that at least NSF recognizes that because in their phase two call, they want to create these climate education partnership alliances where
right.
you have a PI, a representative from your project who participates in that. And, you know, we definitely we started education, like we were climate change education, and then we moved, oh, it's really climate change communication. And that's when we were doing our big literature review. And then it was climate change engagement. And so just for us, we've sort of like shifted through this. And my sense is that other projects have as well. And it'd be fascinating just, you know, how are we going to deal with this incredibly fascinating and increasing body of literature and really gain all the lessons possible.
Well, that would be a good topic to suggest for the meeting, like the trajectory that you talked about, going from education to communication to engagement.
Yeah, it is fascinating. I started graduate work in climate change ed in 2000, and it was like so easy because there was no research on it, you know?
Yeah.
And it took me quite a long time to get through my degree because I had children during the time. And during that time, it was just phenomenal how this, you know, literature increased that, you know, and studies and ways of, and how it went from climate change communication to education to engagement. And it's just really,
yeah.
This is Scott Carley here. I know the climate change education partnerships have all, in the phase ones, have needed to create white papers on education learning science and also on the science in whether they're regional or a thematic partnership. It'd be really interesting if ultimately we can pull those together, and maybe there is a volume to be created here, again, to try to get some of this material shared a little bit more broadly. I think once we finish the phase, people will be comfortable in sharing all of those things, I hope.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
That might be something that can be brought up to either to NSF or even in the tri-agency meeting, which I think is usually, I'm not quite sure when it is, it's usually one in the spring.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like mid-April. I think, because, ours is really focused on public lands and protected areas, but wouldn't it be cool if there was just this edited volume that had a chapter for zoos and aquariums, for formal for K through 5. Well, I guess from what I understand. Anyway, but
we don't do too much K through 5.
You don't do too much K through 5, yeah.
The middle and high school, yeah.
Middle and high school. Yeah, that would be so cool. That would be such a resource. And
yeah,
like for
we should raise that with other folks.
Yeah.
Well, this new, the professional learning community that the North American Association for Environmental Ed is starting now, I think, and just to speak up for environmental ed, we have a huge body of research on not specifically climate change, but on how to talk about environmental issues in general, and also significant life experiences and how those impact your sensitivity to the environment, which is very connected to this place-based geography, so that all exists as well.
Yeah. Could you mention again what exactly that's called, what the name of the learning community is called?
It's just starting,
okay.
And I'm surprised Karen's not on the call, is she?
Okay, yeah.
No, I can send it out to I think it's okay to send it out to everyone in the world. The newsletter. It's starting in March, and it's a professional learning community looking at climate change specifically through the lens of environmental education, so as environmental educators.
Sounds great.
Cool.
Yeah.
That'd be great. Yes, this is Scott Carley. You mentioned the aquariums and zoo, and I'm really struck by the potential for some connections between, you know, it's almost like just scale. It's zoos and aquaria are kind of concentrated. Parks and refuges are quite large, but it's the same kinds of audiences, but you're creating each is creating somewhat different experiences. So I'm kind of curious whether you've thought about some partnerships potentially.
Definitely. We've been part of I'm forgetting what their acronym even stands for, but they had a study circle. They did a supplemental CSEP award and had like an informal climate change learning study circle. And there's just so many opportunities, especially as we think about our pilot areas and it linking to some of the parks. I mean, when we were in the Puget Sound, there's this, you know, the incredible aquarium in Seattle, and met with folks there to say, you know, if this next phase goes through, you have to be part, you know, of this partnership as well, and thinking about how to link the activities again for that consistent voice across, because people who go on vacation and go to visit these places are, like you said, they're doing both. They're going out to the park and they're going to the zoo, they're going to the aquarium, they're going to the Natural History Museum. In fact, Denver Natural History Museum is super psyched about partnering with the Northern Colorado group in the next phase, just to have like this urban, you know, museum experience where they interpret climate change from more of a, through the Anthropocene, you know, through this, how have we changed this climate here?
It is interesting, though, your segmentation of the audience. I know that the Science Museum here in Minnesota did a study looking at what their audience would be, and they pretty much were exactly across the board of the Six Americas study.
Huh.
And I'm not sure if they had a few other museums that did that as well, but it was not, I mean, the fact that the national parks, it seemed like the audience was a little bit more concerned than that study. So that's sort of interesting. You know, you're bringing people that are obviously more inclined to be outside if you're bringing in a slightly different population.
And again, it's immediate for many of those visitors, so they're seeing the effects.
Right.
So into the alarmed and concerned category. Well, are there any other questions for Jess? This is obviously...
I'd like to ask Jessica something.
Yeah, please, jump in.
Jessica, this is David Smith from the University of Redlands. But I used to live up there in northern Colorado. I participated in a place-based education work with the Orton Family Foundation. And I was kind of... So this is really interesting to me. I kind of miss doing this kind of work.
Yeah.
But one of the things we did, I'm kind of curious about in what you're doing in the curriculum and everything. Are you using any like computer mapping as a technology to maybe help pull in participation or with the projects, things like that?
David, that is such an awesome question. Man, if I had all day, I would tell you guys everything. But we did a service learning project with a GIS class last semester, the fall semester, where we worked with a professor teaching GIS, and they used our project and some of the impacts that we had seen, and they created all these incredible maps. Some even layered some of the social data like that we had about visitors with the ecological impacts. It was just like, it was amazing. I could send you the web link to some of the things that they created for us. And now it's just figuring out we just have this this mountain of data and information and ideas for phase two. But I know, yes, technology and visualization.
Maybe you and I could talk offline sometime.
Yeah, that would be great.
I'll send you an email.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Great. There any other questions for Jeff? Well, I'm sure there are, but I think our hour is up, and I'd really like to thank Jessica for her presentation. Just, I mean, obviously opening up a lot of questions for folks, and as they start, just to editorialize here, is what we're starting to see is some understanding of what all the sort of, I think the sort of shift from education through communications engagement, I think we're starting to see that in many of the projects. That's kind of where we're going, and I think it's really exciting to see the kind of similarities and the sort of deepening understanding of the audiences that we're working with. So it's really great, great work.
Cool. Thank you again so much for the invitation.
I just wanted to remind folks, if you look at our list, we have had a lot of presentations in the last 2 or 3 months. We usually only have 2 per month, and we've been pretty much presentations every week. So we only have actually 1 more presentation that's officially listed, but I'll give you a little preview of what we're also working on. One possibility is Richard Ailey, who wants to talk a little bit about, I can't remember the name of his program that he's doing on PBS in April. And I think Richard is going to do a presentation for us in the next couple of weeks. So that announcement will come. Sandy Rutherford from the CCEP for the Great Lakes will probably talk within the next couple of weeks. She's promised something probably later in the month or so. And Josh Rosino and Mark McCaffrey for the National Centers for Science Education that's just started a new program in climate, and I think you probably have seen stuff from Mark, who many people here know quite well. And we're hoping to have a presentation from them. So there'll be a couple more presentations, certainly before the end of May. So keep looking at the schedule for those.
Cool.
So if there's no other comments, I just want to thank Jeff again. Please, if there's something else.
Where would we find out? I'd like to share this with other people for them to go listen to the recording. Where would they do that, and when would it be available?
The recording is on the same page. It's the cleanet.org/CLN telecon _schedule.html. So that's where the abstract is right now and the slides. And once the recording comes through the system, I will put it back up. I'll put it up there, and so the recording will be available on the same web page.
Okay. And how long does that usually take, so I can let them know?
It now depends when Tamara gets a hold of it, because once I get it, I can do it within about 10 or 15 minutes. But it may actually be at the end of the day before.
That's no problem. Okay, great.
Okay. Well, thanks, everyone. And we will have an informal discussion next week, unless there's something formal comes up. So I hope you're able to join us next week. And thanks again to Jessica and everyone who participated.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Great. Bye now.
Thank you. Bye.